A Southern California town tells child migrants, go home. Today, Thursday, July 3rd, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Protesters say it's hard enough to make a living without facing an influx of children from somewhere else.
I work pretty hard, and my wife works 3 jobs to try and pay our bills so we can help our children have a good environment to live in.
But not everyone wants to send the newcomers packing.
It's a racist thing. It's not a loving thing.
Also today, going dry in Colombia for the World Cup, and an American reporter's unsettling encounter with the traditional Chinese liquor called baijiu. There are several different kinds.
But they all share a, at least to me, kind of a nauseating aftertaste.
And the history of gypsies in America, all coming up after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. We've been talking a lot this week about the staggering number of young migrants, children on their own, pouring over the U.S.-Mexico border. President Obama has called it a humanitarian crisis, but some people on the U.S. side of the border are saying enough. On Tuesday, protesters forced buses filled mostly with undocumented Central Americans to be rerouted out of the Southern California city of Murrieta. Last night, an overflow crowd filled a high school auditorium to meet with Homeland Security officials. Protesters chanted, "Send them back, send them back," and voiced concerns over plans to move detained immigrants through a Border Patrol processing facility there. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez was at the meeting.
You had a lot of very outraged people in this community meeting last night who basically don't want them. They were saying, this is the administration's problem. This is the Fed's problem. It is not Murrieta's problem, this small town about 90 miles southeast of Los Angeles. And they want these people sent back directly to their countries of origin in Mexico and in Central America.
Now, it's interesting. We're not talking about these migrants being released out into the streets of Murrieta. What are the people concerned about in Murrieta?
Well, they're actually concerned about that because, the idea is that this is an overflow of people because the facilities in Texas and in New Mexico are just packed full. So they're flying them to other facilities in the Southwest and here in California. They're supposed to go to this one center for a temporary period of time, like, 2 or 3 days to essentially be processed. And then they would be released. They would be sent to, mass transit stations where they're supposed to go to where they wanted to go and then report in with an immigration judge. The people in Murrieta, at least some of them, are concerned that that will never happen. That these migrants, these refugees, will just vanish into the wind and they'll be gone for good. And they'll be in this country illegally for good. That was their concern. And a lot of them, they say, might just stay in Murrieta and, put pressure on their social services, their educational system, and so on.
Now, the numbers are just staggering. More than 52,000 unaccompanied children have been detained crossing the border since October. Saul, you spoke to some residents attending the meeting. Let's hear what they had to say.
I just feel it's detrimental to the welfare of the area financially, potentially criminally.
Does it matter to you that this group here in Murrieta are, as I understand it, largely made up of kids, minors, and their mothers?
Children and mothers, especially mothers of childbearing age, are expensive. Someone has to pay for them to bear children and educate their children and feed their children and give them medical care. I work pretty hard, and my wife works 3 jobs to try and pay our bills so we can help our children have a good environment to live in. So I don't know how any municipality in California is fiscally or financially in a position to raise some other country's children.
It's a racist thing. It's not a loving thing. We're all here to glorify the Lord, and this is not what the Lord would want. I'm out here to support those people who have been turned away. Mostly they are children. And what would they do if their children were in the same situation? They would want somebody to stand up for them.
Now, Saul, what's the ethnic makeup of Murrieta?
Murrieta is, you know, Murrieta is a largely Anglo middle class, upper middle class community, but with a large, you know, Latino population, Hispanic population as well, like so many other communities in the Southwest and in the West. I think it's about 25% Latino, and they were represented too. Although I must admit, it was like going from two worlds in this meeting last night, from the auditorium, which was largely white and older and anti-immigrant, to outside, where you had a lot of Hispanics who were, you know, pro keeping these families in the United States, or at least for a period of time. And it was just these two separate worlds of Murrieta. It was really interesting. It was like going through the looking glass from inside to outside, and all of them equally passionate, a lot of exchange, no violence, nothing like that, but a lot of exchanges of their respective arguments, generally politely, and a lot of very lively discussions before, during, and after this this meeting last night.
Now, I understand some people at this meeting were handing out flyers saying the people on these buses, the people coming from these countries, had diseases. Does the rhetoric that get ratcheted up that high?
It was really interesting, Carol. You heard a lot about this concern about public health and these immigrants and these refugees. A lot of people saying we don't know what they're bringing into this country that could be communicable. And that was really surprising to me. Just about everybody brought that up. And I haven't heard that argument as frequently when it comes to past immigration issues, right? You always hear about, you know, the economic impact, the impact on social services. But the public health angle I hadn't seen. And it was so serious, they had somebody from the county health department there to address just those concerns. And that gentleman basically said, you know, you shouldn't be as worried about that as you think. They are being screened by the feds for health issues. And, you know, you shouldn't worry about this as much as you are.
KCRW's Saul Gonzalez, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Carol.
President Obama has called it a humanitarian crisis. But some people in the U.S. side of the border are saying enough. Last night, an overflow crowd filled a high school auditorium in the Southern California city of Murrieta. Protesters chanted, "Send them back, send them back," and voiced concerns over plans to move detained immigrants through a border control processing facility there. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez was at the meeting. And Saul, on Tuesday, protesters forced buses filled with undocumented Mexicans to be rerouted out of Murrieta. What was last night's meeting about?
Well, Carol, it was about the aftermath of that and what is going to finally happen to these migrants, to these refugees that they're trying to send to Murrieta. They were trying to send to Murrieta. And you had a lot of very outraged people in this community meeting last night who basically don't want them. They were saying, "Nuh-uh, this is the administration's problem. This is the Fed's problem. It is not Murrieta's problem, this small town about 90 miles southeast of Los Angeles." And they want these people sent back directly to their countries of origin in Mexico and in Central America.
Now, it's interesting. We're not talking about these migrants being released out into the streets of Murrieta. What are the people concerned about in Murrieta?
Well, they're actually concerned about that because, you know, the idea is that this is an overflow of people because the facilities in Texas and in New Mexico are just packed full. So they're flying them to other facilities in the Southwest and here in California. They're supposed to go to this one center for a temporary period of time, like, you know, 2 or 3 days to essentially be processed. And then they would be released. They would be sent to, you know, mass transit stations where they're supposed to go to where they wanted to go and then report in with an immigration judge. The people in Murrieta, at least some of them, are concerned that that will never happen, that these migrants, these refugees will just vanish into the wind and they'll be gone for good and they'll be in this country illegally for good. That was their concern. And a lot of them, they say, might just stay in Murrieta and, you know, put pressure on their social services or educational system and so on.
Now, the numbers are just staggering. More than 52,000 unaccompanied children have been detained crossing the crossing the border since October. Saul, you spoke to some residents attending the meeting. Let's hear what they had to say.
I just feel it's detrimental to the welfare of the area financially, potentially criminally.
Does it matter to you that this group here in Murrieta are, as I understand it, largely made up of kids, minors, and their mothers?
Children and mothers, especially mothers of childbearing age, are expensive. Someone has to pay for them to bear children and educate their children and feed their children and give them medical care. I work pretty hard, and my wife works 3 jobs to try and pay our bills so we can help our children have a good environment to live in. So I don't know how any municipality in California is fiscally or financially in a position to raise some other country's children.
It's a racist thing. It's not a loving thing. We're all here to glorify the Lord, and this is not what the Lord would want. I'm out here to support those people who have been turned away. Mostly they are children. And what would they do if their children were in the same situation? They would want somebody to stand up for them.
Now, Saul, what's the ethnic makeup of Murrieta?
Murrieta is a largely Anglo middle class, upper middle class community, but with a large, Latino population, Hispanic population as well, like so many other communities in the Southwest and in the West. I think it's about 25% Latino, and they were represented too. Although I must admit, it was like going from two worlds in this meeting last night, from the auditorium, which was largely white and older and anti-immigrant, to outside, where you had a lot of Hispanics who were pro keeping these families in the United States, or at least for a period of time. And it was just these two separate worlds of Murrieta. It was really interesting. It was like going through the looking glass from inside to outside, and all of them equally passionate, a lot of exchange, no violence, nothing like that, but a lot of exchanges of their respective arguments, generally politely, and a lot of very lively discussions before, during, and after this meeting last night.
Now, I understand some people at this meeting were handing out flyers saying the people on these buses, the people coming from these countries, had diseases. Does the rhetoric that get ratcheted up that high?
It was really interesting, Carol. You heard a lot about this concern about public health and these immigrants and these refugees. A lot of people saying we don't know what they're bringing into this country that could be communicable. And that was really surprising to me. Just about everybody brought that up. And I haven't heard that argument as frequently when it comes to past immigration issues, right? You always hear about, the economic impact, the impact on social services. But the public health angle I hadn't seen. And it was so serious, they had somebody from the county health department there to address just those concerns. And that gentleman basically said, you shouldn't be as worried about that as you think. They are being screened by the feds for health issues. And, you shouldn't worry about this as much as you are.
KCRW's Saul Gonzalez, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Carol.
We're making a turn here to the World Cup. If you've been watching the games this year, you just might recognize our next guest by the sound of his voice. He's someone who moves between English and Spanish-speaking worlds. Fernando Palomo is one of the play-by-play announcers on ESPN. He's commentating this World Cup in English, but his first language is actually Spanish. Palomo grew up in El Salvador and began his broadcast career there. It's only recently that he started doing soccer play-by-play in English. We reached Fernando Palomo at ESPN headquarters in Rio.
The first game in English was actually in Phoenix in January of last year, Denmark against Mexico, and I was as nervous can get. If I could, I would have scripted all scenarios possible for all 90 minutes of the game, so just I didn't stumble into words. But it's a learning process. I come from having called games in Spanish for a long time, and I have my own style, and I try to bring that along into English, but I realize it's something that I can't do right off the bat, that I needed to kind of morph both styles and try to become one Fernando Palomo in English and one in Spanish, although having one common aspect with both of them, which is passion. I can't translate passion. That's something you're born with. And that I put into my Spanish language commentary. And that's the same thing I bring into the English language broadcasting.
So it's interesting. It was just a year ago that you did your first game in English. Are there any things that you hold back from calling a game in English? Are there words that just don't translate?
Well, there are words that don't translate, and there are, common phrases that are used in Spanish that don't go well in the English language. I can't translate the dynamics of calling a game in Spanish because the vocabulary is just way broader in Spanish for me than it is in English. So if I try to bring that along, I'm just going to stumble in the process and fall, and definitely I don't want to fall on air.
So what are some of the phrases you'd use in Spanish that just don't work in English?
Ooh, there's one in particular. I also called the popular video game, the FIFA video game, in Spanish. I'm the voice for that alongside Mario Kempes, who also works for ESPN. And there's a phrase that I've always used but caught on, or actually caught fire pretty much when it came out on the video game. And it's every time somebody shoots from outside the box or a hard shot even inside the box, I say in Spanish, zapatazo, in a very loud voice. Zapatazo means big shot with your shoe, you know, something that just doesn't translate. I can't do it, and I can't find anything in English that would just substitute that word and bring it the same effect. If you have ideas, I'm more than welcome to.
Great kid.
You're more than welcome to bring them along.
Now, I want to switch topics a bit. And last week we heard an interview that my colleague Marco Werman did with Felix Sanchez, who was disturbed by Univision's Spanish language coverage of the World Cup. And let me play a clip from Sanchez.
English language leaning Latinos like myself join for more authentic experience with Univision. But sometimes we get surprised by some of the things or some of the characterizations we hear.
Like what?
Well, I think most recently was characterization related to an Afro-Costa Rican player describing him not by his last name, but by the color of his skin, calling him Moreno.
Now, we heard from hundreds of listeners who disagreed with Sanchez. One listener, Jesse Dillon, wrote in and said, "The point of Univision is to reach people who participate in the Latino culture in the U.S. market. They're not using racial slurs to refer to players. They're using familiar nicknames. The bottom line is that you can't translate into U.S. English what they're saying without losing something important." Well, what do you think about Sanchez's claim?
Well, I respect his claim, yeah, but you have to understand the culture as well to know where, you know, broadcasters were leaned towards calling players by their nickname and not by their first or last name. We in Latin America called each other mostly, or sometimes, I would say, or it's not rare to do so, by our nickname. And sometimes our nicknames are given by our skin color or hair color or height. And it's not offensive when you do it in the context of the Latin American culture. Now, understanding where broadcasters in Spanish reach, which is the U.S. market, U.S. Hispanic market, that's a whole different culture. And we at ESPN go to many different markets and many different cultures. There's a plethora of cultures out there that we reach. You can't just translate one thing said in Spanish into English straight without, again, losing a lot of the background in the middle.
Now, I know you're with ESPN and not Univision. I'm curious how your Spanish commentary has changed from when you were doing play-by-play for El Salvador.
I wouldn't say a lot, but when I'm calling a game, regardless of the language I'm using, our media is so special and unique that you are giving the audience a picture and you just need to illustrate the context of the picture but not explain to them what they're already seeing, which is an easy concept to explain but a hard one to grasp once you're doing the job.
I want to end this by asking you about the remainder of the World Cup. We've got about a week left, and will we be hearing you back on air?
I don't know, since assignments have not been handed out yet.
So if you could pick, which one would you pick?
If I had to pick one, I would do a Brazil game regardless of which stage they're in. When you're doing a World Cup game in the nation that considers the sport a religion more than a sport itself, and you're in there with 60,000 or 70,000 worshippers watching their 11 gods on the field, that is as amazing a sport experience as you can live. I did one already against Mexico, but I would certainly love to do one again. And if you ask me which one I would pick to do, would be Brazil-Colombia next time.
ESPN announcer Fernando Palomo, he's been covering the World Cup games in Brazil. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can hear more about how language is affecting this year's World Cup games. Join the conversation at PRI.org. And coming up tomorrow on The World, we're having a French 4th of July. Colonial America beat the British. And they did it with no small help from the French. We'll hear about one French aristocrat, the Vicomte de Noailles, who helped General Washington win the war against Britain at the Battle of Yorktown.
It was a French and American victory. It was a Franco-American victory at Yorktown. And Noailles went in as the French representative, settled the terms of the surrender of Yorktown, and it was French and American forces that watched as the British evacuated the fort. And there's a famous scene where the British commander of Yorktown tries to surrender his arms to the French, and it would have been to Noailles, therefore, and Noailles refused. And it was, therefore, the kind of humiliating gesture where the British commander was forced to surrender his arms to the Americans, to Washington.
Our Forgotten French Connection, tomorrow on The World. This is PRI. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're going to head to Colombia now for a little more World Cup action. The Colombian team's been having a great run so far. They've won 4 straight games. And tomorrow they face the host, Brazil, in the quarterfinals. No surprise, Colombians have been going a little crazy over all of this. Even the FARC rebels sent the team a fan letter. It's been so raucous that several people have been killed in post-game celebrations in Bogota. So to calm things down, authorities have imposed a ban on alcohol sales on game days. Here's John Otis from Bogota.
In its opening World Cup match last month, Colombia beat Greece 3-0. The team's victory set off wild, drunken street parties that got completely out of hand. Police registered thousands of fights, hundreds of injuries, and 9 deaths. A few days later, inebriated fans blocked streets and hijacked a city bus. More than 200 people were arrested. The violence has prompted officials in Bogota and several other cities to say no alcohol sales when Colombia plays its World Cup matches. I spent some time in a Bogota park where mostly sober soccer fans gathered to watch Colombia's game against Uruguay on a giant outdoor screen. The revelry began long before Colombia won the match 2-0. But there were no soccer-related deaths after the match. Police officer Carlos Holguin, who was keeping an eye on the crowded park, says the dry law is working. People have been very well behaved, Holguin says. There were only about a dozen fights this time, compared to 3,000 fights after Colombia's first game. But many bar and restaurant owners are furious. This is Colombia's first appearance in the World Cup since 1998. It's been a long wait, and they were gearing up for crowded viewing parties and big profits. Some hired extra bartenders and waiters and upgraded their technology.
En audio tenemos estas plantas.
Juan Carlos Hernandez, manager of the Havana 93 bar, shows me the new TVs, sound system, and movie screen he installed for the World Cup. They cost about $4,000.
No, creo que ni nosotros ni en otro sitio lo hace.
But since the bar can't serve alcohol, people have stayed away in droves. Hernandez says he never would have made the investment had he known about the dry law.
Estábamos esperando que el mundial fuera algo. De atraer mucho más clientela.
At a nearby pizza parlor, manager Raul Hoyos says, we thought the World Cup would mean much more business, but our sales have fallen 30 to 50%. Soccer hooligans plague many countries, but the brawls usually pit the fans of one team against those of another. For the World Cup, Colombians are all cheering for the same side. So why would they turn on each other? It's happened before. In 1993, Colombia scored a major upset by blowing out Argentina 5-0 in a World Cup qualifier. The post-game celebrations turned ugly, and 60 people were killed.
But why Colombia?
I don't know.
Mari Castro waits tables at a Bogota restaurant.
Pienso que después de 16 años de volver a un mundial.
She thinks the problem is that soccer glory is such a rare occurrence for Colombia. This is the first time we've qualified for the World Cup in 16 years, she points out. People just get too excited and don't know how to control themselves. Whatever the reason, many Bogotanos tell me they support the dry law. It may hurt business, says high school teacher Miguel Valdivieso, but it's good for the city because it saves lives. For The World, I'm John Otis in Bogota, Colombia.
From banning alcohol to promoting it, there's an effort underway to introduce American drinkers to something new. It's actually a traditional Chinese liquor. It's called baijiu. A few different companies are hoping this stuff becomes the next big thing at a bar near you. Isaac Stonefish is the Asia editor at Foreign Policy magazine. He's been writing about the baijiu phenomenon. First off, Isaac, the name means white liquor. Kind of sounds like Chinese moonshine. What does it taste like?
There's a lot of different types, and they have different flavors and kind of different ends and beginnings, but they all share a, at least to me, kind of a nauseating aftertaste, like you bit your tongue too hard when you were drinking and your mouth is filled with blood. So I guess long story short, I'm not a huge fan of these drinks.
Not exactly a way to promote it. So nope. Let's get to the origins. You spent time in China. How do people there drink it?
China has a great drinking and banquet culture. So baijiu is often consumed in tiny little shot glasses at the beginning, the middle, and the end of a giant meal where, you know, anywhere from 2 to 20 or 50 people will sit around a group of tables, share the food, and will toast each other with this alcohol. And it's a bonding experience to all have this shared pain together.
So how is it going to be marketed to Americans?
I think different companies are taking different strategies. Some are taking the strategy that this is Chinese culture that they should learn to appreciate. There's a brand called Confucius Wisdom, which has a picture of the sage on it, and which tries to have this be kind of an essential Chinese cultural aspect. There's another brand called Baijiu, B-Y-E-J-O-E, which takes the opposite approach, which says, hey, here's this thing that's very popular in China. We're going to try to soften the edges and have it be something a little more East-West-ish. There's a very attractive, generic-looking woman on the bottle. The bottle is a much more slim, kind of like absolute vodka-ish design as opposed to baijiu bottles, which traditionally are kind of short and squat. So I think they're saying, hey, take this and go with it.
So is it available anywhere right now in the U.S.?
Mostly duty-free, some dodgy liquor stores in Chinatowns across the country, and in a very small number of bars. A lot of them are Asian, attached to Asian fusion restaurants that have these in cocktails.
Who's the demographic they're going after in the U.S.?
They're going after the Chinese businessmen who are in the States, American businessmen who drink with Chinese businessmen when they come to the States, and those who want to have a kind of quote-unquote authentic Asian experience.
Oh, so I thought they were going to go for sort of hipsters and bars and you got to try this and this is hip and cool. So they're going after a sort of logical market here.
I think I agree with you. I think the kind of hipster Bushwick, like drink this and we can complain about it together market is a much stronger market, but they're going the more traditional route.
Now, I know you did a taste test with some of your colleagues at your office in Washington. We have a video of it at our website, PRI.org. But for those who aren't looking at it right now, what did they think of it?
The reactions were mixed. I think someone described it as sparkling. Another person said window cleaner. We had someone who compared it to the London Blitz, which I thought was appropriate. So I think if one wanted to make a conclusion, I don't think it's something that they will be drinking regularly.
So I guess they are targeting the right market.
It's an acquired taste, yeah.
Isaac Stonefish is an editor with Foreign Policy Magazine. He's based in Washington. Thanks a lot, Isaac.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Carol Hills. Ahead, a dressmaker's booming business in gowns for American Roma.
I know what the gypsies want. I've been working with them for years. I started with them, 34 years ago maybe. And it just grew because the dresses I made at the beginning blew their minds and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills, here for Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. July 4th is coming a little early this year, at least for us here in Boston. The Boston Pops usually have their big concert right on the night of the 4th, followed by nationally televised fireworks. But there's been a last-minute decision to move it all up a day. Blame it on Hurricane Arthur. It's the first Atlantic hurricane of the season. And along with the shuffling of events here in Boston, it's causing trouble farther south, including North Carolina, which is being hit by significant coastal flooding. That kind of flooding, usually called a storm surge, is becoming more and more of a problem as sea levels rise around the world. And that's why, just in time for Arthur, we now have a way to see what kind of storm surges a big coastal storm might bring with it. It's the country's first real-time storm surge map. The World's environment editor Peter Thompson spoke earlier today with the guy who headed up the project. His name is Jamie Rome, and he runs the Storm Surge Unit at the National Hurricane Center in Miami.
Actually, this is a pretty revolutionary step forward in our ability to predict and communicate storm surge. In the past, we relied primarily on text products to communicate storm surge, which it's very hard to talk about a hazard that varies on a local scale, you know, meaning it could be, you know, 1 foot of surge in one spot and then 5 feet of surge right down the road. And so the new feature that was launched for this storm for the first time ever provides high resolution mapping that helps viewers to visualize where the water could go, and people can zoom in and then see how their community might be impacted by storm surge.
For those of our listeners who don't live on or near the coast, tell me a little bit about storm surge, what it is, and why a tool like this is so important.
So storm surge, is in the simplest form, is just the force of the wind in a hurricane or a winter storm just driving the ocean towards the land. And if the winds are strong enough, it pushes the water over the land and up rivers and into tidal tributaries and all these areas. And you know, one of the things we've historically been challenged with storm surge is we could convince people right along the beach that the ocean has a potential to invade their home. That was a relatively easy sell. But what was really, really hard is to convince people that might be 10, 15, 20 miles inland that salt water could invade their homes. It just seems so mentally impossible that it was really hard to get these people to evacuate during a storm. What this new map does is enable them to visually see, you know, the water can, in fact, impact inland communities.
Now, obviously, storm surge has been a problem for as long as there have been hurricanes, which goes back to way before there were even people. But my understanding is that this is going to be more and more of a problem in the United States and around the world as sea levels rise and things get dicier in the climate of the near future.
Yeah, so there's two reasons why my job will get increasingly difficult as we march along. First and foremost, coastal population trends are going up, meaning people are moving to the coastline. So that means more people, more things, harder evacuations. The other thing is the ocean or sea level was rising. And that's happening regardless of one's view of climate change and what's causing it. The ocean is absolutely rising. And that provides a higher base for storm surges to form upon. And so if the sea level is rising, even by relatively small amounts, say a half a foot or a foot, that'll make coastal communities far more vulnerable to future storm surge events.
And looking back, I mean, obviously we've had a number of major storms in which storm surge has been an issue in the last decade or so. How might this tool have helped us in the case of Sandy or Katrina or Ike?
It's always hard to look back and say, you know, what would have been. I can tell you what people have told me. You know, people who were on the ground level during Sandy said that having this capability during Sandy would have significantly changed the story that occurred.
Looking ahead, is this kind of system available anywhere else in the world? Will it be anytime soon?
Nothing this sophisticated and complex, to my knowledge, exists anywhere else in the world. In fact, other countries have approached the Hurricane Center wanting to know about this approach, interested in how we implemented it, interested in what we did. My guess is this new capability will not only influence the future of storm surge forecasting here in the U.S., but perhaps globally.
Jamie Rome runs the Storm Surge Unit at the National Hurricane Center in Miami. He spoke with the world's environment editor, Peter Thompson. When it comes to spying on its own citizens, the former East Germany certainly had a lock on things. The Stasi secret police kept very close tabs on what East Germans were doing. That dark past shapes the perceptions and political views of young adults living in Germany today. One place where some of those conversations play out is at the Chaos Computer Club in Germany. It's part hacker club, part advocacy group. Earlier, I spoke with one of the members, Julius Mittensvei. He said it's important for people to speak up for digital rights now as technology becomes even more integrated into our daily lives.
In the future, every social interaction will have a component which is over the internet. And knowing that, there is the possibility that people can build kind of life profiles of us. So knowing the possibility that there is an omniscient narrator, knowing from the whole population of the planet Earth everything, their moods, their relationships, probably what they will do in the future. And that gives persons so much power of everybody. And we think that that might be, or that could be in the near future, a big threat to our democracy.
Now, digital surveillance, any kind of surveillance, has particular resonance in Germany. Tell us about that.
I don't know the reason for that. Probably that in recent history, we overcome two dictatorships. And so we know how much impact it could have if the government knows so much about the people and the government tries to control everybody. So that's why probably we are very skeptical if a single person or the state knows so much about you.
Certainly during the time of East Germany and the Stasi, which kept files on just about everyone. Is that what motivates you to get active in the issue of internet privacy?
Yeah, just imagine if the Stasi would have the capabilities the NSA has today, Eastern Germany probably would still exist. And, well, that's the reason why we don't want to have anybody to have so much control and so much knowledge about everybody.
Now, how did you and your friends react to the Edward Snowden revelations about massive spying by the NSA and Britain's NSA, known as the GCHQ?
It was kind of interesting. All the people who are in IT security, every single attack and every single threat, we know that that was possible. But the thing what was new is that really the NSA and their British friends did that surveillance on an industrial scale. And we knew that SSL, the Internet Security Protocol, is vulnerable to certain attacks. But we did not really think of it that people try to break it on the global level and try to intercept SSL worldwide. And that, I have to say, and I have to admit, that that really shocked us.
What is SSL?
SSL is if you do online banking and the bar in the URL in your browser turns green and shows that lock, that's SSL.
Now, is there a generational sort of split in Germany in terms of attitudes towards surveillance?
If you would ask me that 1 year ago, I would have said, well, only the young people care about it. But after the Snowden revelations, also, my mom understands why that is a real threat to our society.
Why did your mother react so strongly to Snowden? What about that particular episode moved her?
The reason is, if you would have asked her 1 year ago, she would say the NSA could know what I was talking to you or to my friends. But then after the Snowden revelations, people realized that everybody was affected by these spyings and everybody is a victim. And they are not only collecting data from some high-profile persons, they are trying to collect everything and then to find the needle in the haystack. And we are part of that haystack.
Final question. What do you think people in the U.S. should understand about government and internet surveillance in Germany?
Well, they have to understand that people are very critical about having somebody and having a different foreign country trying to record everything they do online. And that they have to understand that from our perspective, that is not acceptable, that somebody tries to get a copy of your digital life.
Julius Mittensvei is a lawyer and member of the Chaos Computer Club in Germany. Thanks a lot, Julius.
Welcome.
We'd like to hear what you think about these issues. And here's a shout out to all you millennials. Are your views on internet surveillance different than your parents? It's all part of our ongoing coverage of how millennials around the world view cybersecurity issues. Tell us on Facebook at facebook.com/PRI the world. Indonesia has the largest Muslim population in the world, and it's common for devout students there to attend Islamic boarding schools called pesantren. They're fairly traditional schools. They teach the Quran, Arabic language, and Islamic law. But there is one pesantren in the city of Yogyakarta that's a little different. It's just for transgender women. Jess Engebretsen has the story from Yogyakarta.
About five women lay out books, mats, and glasses of hot tea on a shady veranda. Arabic class is about to begin. These students are all Wariya, transgender women. One of the students chanting the alphabet is a stout woman named Bunda Yeti. She's been studying here for several years. Bunda was raised as a boy, but says she knew early on that she was really a girl. Indonesians are relatively tolerant when it comes to transgender women, but discrimination is still widespread. Many struggle to get identity cards, which are required for voting. Medical care can be hard to access, too. And Bunda struggled with another problem. How and where should she pray? In Indonesia's mosques, men and women pray separately and wear different religious garb. Bunda didn't fit into either category.
Yeah, mengabaikan.
She says, it was a struggle for me. Normally, I would have joined the men's section, but I was wearing a dress and makeup. And could I pray with the women? Of course not. Everyone would stare at me, and I would never feel comfortable. Nobody wanted me in the mosque. So she stopped going. I just prayed at home, she says, but I couldn't do the full five prayers a day. For major holidays, I might go to the public square, but how could I pray at the mosque? I had fallen away from God. Then, in 2008, a friend of hers opened this Islamic school, just for Waria. It's a small, informal setup. No grades, no graduation, only about 20 students. But for the first time in years, Bunda felt she had a place to practice her faith. As dusk falls, the students prepare for evening prayers. Though they all identify as women, their dress runs the gamut. Bunda wears a sarong and pechi cap, traditionally male attire, along with a ponytail and red toenail polish. Others prefer more traditional female clothing, headscarves and brightly colored mukena. After dinner, they hear a presentation from a visiting Islamic scholar. He tells them that Islam has room for transgender people, quoting the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. And the students applaud, enthusiastically. The school's director, Sinta Ratri, is also a Waria. She says these classes deepen the students' faith, but they're also a chance to educate the teachers.
Untuk sekarang orang-orang lebih open mind, the people more open mind about transgender. Yeah, but in this religion, no.
She says religious attitudes are stuck just where they've always been. So we have a strategy to reach out to the religious establishment going through Islamic university teachers. Others in the LGBT community here aren't so sure. Community activist Angarista Aprianto is quick to say he's not anti-religion. He's a devout Muslim himself. But he worries that trying to win over religious leaders is a waste of time.
In Indonesia, we have little hardliner Muslim, but they have a big influence and big role in our government.
He says it's just more practical to work with secular human rights groups to gain acceptance. Sinta, the Pesantren director, says she knows that most religious leaders have been slow to change their views. But she says her small school is gaining support from an unlikely place, a university run by Indonesia's largest Islamic group, Nahdlatul Ulama, has agreed to provide the school with teachers and support. She shows me the signed document that she plans to hang on the wall. The agreement won't change all that much on a day-to-day basis, she says, but the symbolism still matters. For The World, I'm Jess Engebretsen, Yogyakarta, Indonesia.
This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. But you'd probably rather be watching reality TV, right? It's okay. It's a guilty pleasure. Those Real Housewives and Bachelorettes, those wacky people on TLC's My Big Fat American Gypsy Wedding. But some gypsies, who generally refer to themselves as Romani, aren't very happy about how the show makes them look. The World's intern, Marcel Hutchins, has the story.
It's a sunny afternoon in Waltham, Massachusetts,
and Sandra Celli's dressmakers are working hard. They're busy adding crystal embellishments to cheerleader uniforms and finishing off a blinged-out party dress.
Laura is making a graduation cap with the girl's initials and the date and a pair of scissors because she's graduating from a hairdressing school. So this is her graduation cap, and that's got to go out today. And that's actually for a gypsy whose daughter went to school, which is very unusual. So she called, and we have to overnight this today.
You may know Sandra Celli from My Big Fat American Gypsy Wedding.
Oh my God, look at that.
How gorgeous is that? Here's your shoes.
Oh my God.
And a platform. A bouquet, and it lights up.
The show features her outrageous creations for American gypsies.
I know what the gypsies want. I've been working with them for years. I started with them, 34 years ago maybe, and it just grew because the dresses I made at the beginning blew their minds, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Gypsies travel thousands of miles to work with Celli to create their dream wedding dress. She isn't gypsy, but she understands a gypsy bride's fashion priorities.
Bling to them is their status. They just wear it all over their bodies as a material thing, and they show their bling as a, you know, basically whoever has the most money wears the most bling, and that's just how it is. It's not sewing the dress. It's applying Swarovski crystal to everything that costs money.
As a designer, Celli has a wide variety of clients, but she says nothing is as exciting as working with a gypsy. But much of what Americans see of gypsy culture on TV is not only exciting. It's violent. Brides and grooms fighting and family members brawling with each other. That's not the whole story. Gypsies, American Roma, or Romani, have a rich history. Ian Hancock is Romani and studies Romani culture at the University of Texas. He says they started migrating from India to Central and Eastern Europe about 1,000 years ago. And they've been coming to the U.S. since the 1800s.
Roma were being sent here to work in the plantations during the colonial period. Other groups came with the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Different ways, during the colonial period, the French were sending Roma here, the Spanish, the Portuguese.
There are currently over 1 million Romani Americans, according to the U.S. Census. Most of them live in western and southern states. As for the Roma versus Gypsy debate, Hancock goes with Roma or Romani. The term Gypsy, after all, comes with a lot of baggage.
My father used to tell me all the time to never ever steal anything. That's one of the most common stereotypes about Roma people.
Cristiana Grigore is Roma from Romania. She came to the United States 8 years ago as a Fulbright student. She says that from an early age, she decided she didn't want to be a gypsy.
I grew up in a family that wanted to assimilate it and strive to be part of mainstream society. And I always knew about my Roma background, but I hid it because I associated with something very negative.
Grigore says that with all the negative stereotypes, shows like My Big Fat American Gypsy Wedding don't help.
I know it is very disrespectful. It presents the Roma people in a light that we don't really like. I think it's not representative to the most of us.
Back at Sandra Celli's design studio, her phone has been ringing off the hook. A gypsy bride is in a panic over a dress. For a bridal dressmaker, Roma or gypsy, the bride is always right. For the world, I'm Marcel Hutchins.
Marcel was brave enough to try on a party dress designed by Sandra Celli. You can see her rocking a lime green and crystal number and see a photo slideshow of some of Celli's creations. That's all at PRI.org. If you thought 1 month of World Cup extravaganza wasn't enough, imagine adding 3 more days. That's what would happen if soccer's governing body, FIFA, expands the number of teams in the initial round from 32 to 40. It's a rumor that's been floating around soccer's inner circles.
It's a distinct possibility. I wouldn't say it's a probability, but certainly there are some powerful forces behind that expansion.
Roger Kittleson is a professor at Williams College and author of The Country of Football, Soccer, and the Making of Modern Brazil. The World Cup was first held in 1930 in Uruguay. 13 teams competed. Now the hundreds of competing countries vie for 32 spots. Qualifying tournaments are held in the 6 geographic zones around the world designated by FIFA. So how does FIFA decide how many teams come from each zone? You'll be shocked to learn that it's complicated and varies slightly for each World Cup, but it's based on how good the teams are in each zone. But Kittleson says all this talk of expanding the World Cup is more about FIFA politics than quality of play.
The current head of FIFA, Sepp Blatter, who's been under a lot of criticism for alleged corruption scandals, a couple of proven corruption scandals that didn't necessarily touch him, but that have come under his watch, he is now openly running for re-election. And like other FIFA presidents in the past, he sees expansion as a way of gathering more votes in his favor.
There's no denying that Africa and Asia are underrepresented. Africa has 5 automatic spots, while Asia has 4. Europe's got 13. But it's unclear if expanding teams would help or hurt the current setup.
I think that they have to find a way to bring down the cost of hosting this kind of mega event, whether they stay at 32, but especially if they go to 40 teams.
The World Cup is in its third week and will go until July 13th. And we end this program with one more World Cup note. We've been asking you to share your favorite soccer-related songs, past or present. Many of you have weighed in, and we want to play another of your suggestions.
É se você disser que eu não produzo nada, que eu não sou ninguém, que eu vivo minha vida liso sem que tem, pior pra você.
Brian Taylor picked the song Paz de Futebol from Brazilian singer-songwriter Marcos Valle. The 1971 song means Peace Soccer.
Não tem tempo na vida, a vida vai, o tempo vai, não volta mais. É que a verdade...
Hopefully there'll be no more biting incidents this weekend. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
Se você disser que eu não produzo nada, que eu não sou ninguém, que eu vivo minha vida liso sem que tem, pior pra você. O arraso tem o sol, eu tenho sangue, família e si bemol, eu tenho minha amada base e futebol.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.